Yes, I said to them, you are really, for Mr. Booker, the best proposition. You are really a Booker orchestra. And they love it, and that is the touching thing of them. They listen, and that is their world. It's very strange.
There's all this pain, what, spiritual anguish that we haven't heard before, have we, in Bruckner, really?
Well, the 8th comes closer to it already, but the 9th is very special. And one should not make comparisons with the end of life, and then after that couldn't compose anymore. No, he couldn't compose because he died. He wanted to compose a finale very much, and there's a great loss, great sadness that he couldn't complete it. But one has to accept that and not mess around. And this idea of different composers trying their hand on it, I really don't like that.
Despite that, these three incredible movements that we have, is it still the summation of his life's achievement that he wanted it to be?
Could be. It is his most advanced work. It shows the way to the new Viennese school, in a way. It's wonderful, very gripping.
Bernard Haitink. Bruckner's spiritual core was defined by his experiences of religion and nature. For him, the fundamental purpose of his life was to glorify God. He'd grown up beneath the Austrian Alps, and their stillness and majesty permeate his music, all the more so because for him, nature was an expression of God's divinity. Bruckner was one of the finest organists of his day. He gave a recital on the organ here in the Albert Hall the year it was opened. His symphonies contain massive blocks of sound, and changes of texture sound like a change of organ registration. In failing health, he worked on his 9th symphony for 9 years and was still working on it the day he died, though during that time his insecurity caused him obsessively to revise his earlier symphonies too. That insecurity and his personal loneliness made him very vulnerable. His need for order and his Catholic faith hid something unstable, even chaotic, which appears more clearly than ever in this last music. The monumental first movement has an otherworldly intensity, seeming a portent of death, maybe, rather than his usual Brucknerian hymn of thanksgiving. The extraordinary scherzo seems doom-laden too. There's nothing of the Austrian country dance of earlier symphonies here. The composer Robert Simpson writes of it that the music compels and repels as it snakes across the scene. There is nothing like it elsewhere in the composer's music. And as for the slow movement, in its own way, it provides a real conclusion to the officially incomplete work, a movement full of rich but subdued orchestral colour. Maybe a song of farewell to life. Much more packed Albert Hall platform now, as you can imagine. Always great to see when the horn players also bring on the Wagner tubas with them, careful as they mount the steps not to trip and let a valuable brass instrument roll down. And all is ready for Bernard Haitink returning to the Royal Albert Hall platform and joining the Vienna Philharmonic to conduct Anton Bruckner's 9th Symphony.
Thank you.
A song of yearning at the end of which heaven's gates open was how Bruckner's editor described that final adagio of his unfinished Ninth Symphony. And the composer himself referred to the Wagner tuba writing in that movement as his departure from this life as it gently ebbed away. And the symphony was performed here in the Royal Albert Hall live on Radio 3 to end the first of this evening's two BBC Proms by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, concertmaster Rainer Kuchel, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Back comes Bernard Haitink. You kind of almost see the ghostly figure of Anton Bruckner on the organ stool, and you hope he would hear this reception for the culmination of his life's work. An incredibly vigorous, vital octogenarian on the podium tonight. And he may have had the score in front of him, but it never moved from the first page. Going round all the string players, saluting the first desks, very much as always in the middle of his orchestra, not out on the front. Well, Bruckner left some 200 pages of sketches for the finale. Some say he was working on the very last pages when he died. Some of those appear to have been taken by souvenir hunters. Nonetheless, the sketches have recently been realised. Bernard Haitink, however, as he said, sticks with the three movements, saying you have to respect life, but you also have to respect death. If you've just come back, caught the end of that performance, then I'm sure you may well want to catch it on the iPlayer, and you can hear it for the next week. And the horns being brought to their feet. Listen to that noise. And the heavy brass. Hopefully the Wagner tubas. And the wind. Well, even without the finale that Bruckner just couldn't complete, his Ninth Symphony is still an extraordinary and magnificent piece. The Vienna Philharmonic and Bernard Haitink, as you can hear, have enthralled the Albert Hall with their performance of it here this evening. Personally, I can't wait for more from this great combination, so join me at 7:30 tomorrow evening when they juxtapose Haydn's final great symphony of the London with Richard Strauss's celebration both of the mountains of Bavaria and of life, his Alpine Symphony. But for now, it's time I handed you on to James Jolly at Broadcasting House to guide you through the rest of your Radio 3 evening. James.
Thank you, Martin. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall. And we return to the Royal Albert Hall later this evening for a prom given by the Congolese street band Stuffbender Bilili. That's at 10:15. Well, we've a little time before our next programme, Hungary's Soul, Liszt and Gypsy Music, so I thought we'd hear them from members of this evening's prom orchestra, the Vienna Philharmonic, and their former first harp, Xavier de Maistre. Here's Debussy's Two Dances for Harp and Strings.
Thank you.
Debussy's Danse Sacrée et Danse Profane for harp and strings, played by Xavier de Maistre with members of the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. And you can hear the Vienna Phil in tomorrow's prom at 7:30, Bernhard Haitink again conducting Haydn's last symphony, number 104, The London, and after the interval, Richard Strauss's Mighty Alpine Symphony. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Now another chance to hear a feature first broadcast on the 200th anniversary of Liszt's birth last year. The Hungarian-born poet George Surtees returns to Budapest to uncover the myths surrounding Liszt's relationship with gypsy music. He begins in the house of Bálint Sarosi, Kodály's last living student, listening to field recordings of gypsy music.
The guitar. Gypsy song. What has it? To dance. Gypsy dance music. Gypsy original gypsy. I recorded it in a restaurant. That is a simple melody. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Gypsies are playing and people in the restaurant are singing. You can hear the difference. What is the song melody and what is transforming into instrumental music.
I'm standing in Fisherman's Bastion. That is the 19th century fantasy castle on top of the hill in Budapest, where I first came in 1984 on my first return visit. I'm looking out over the Danube, which is grey on this day. But I've come here to Budapest to try and rediscover something. On that first occasion, I came here and we sat down in a restaurant, myself and my wife, and there was a gypsy band playing. A man began to play. He did the usual sort of thing. He came to the table. He saw my wife and leaned close to her ear and started playing. They play tunes which I recognized. They are tunes which my parents knew. They are tunes which they found in Liszt. They found them in the Rhapsodies. They found them in the songs. They found them in Brahms. And they had what they thought was a raw material. And that meant the world to them. It was real music. What I'm here to do now is to find out how real it was. It's the 200th anniversary of Liszt's birth, and the most appropriate thing is to come here and find out what Liszt found. He wrote a book about it, after all. He wrote a whole book called Gypsy Music in 1859. He wrote it in French because he couldn't speak Hungarian. I want to follow the book, and I want to follow the clues that lead from the book as to what he meant by gypsy music, what might be meant by gypsy music by other people, and what is it about all of this that is or is not Hungarian, that which so moved my parents and which moved me too in that restaurant, where when the music began to play, despite myself, I found myself in tears. Before I got to Budapest, I spoke to the concert pianist, Leslie Howard, the great exponent of Liszt's works.
Is it Liszt who coins the term gypsy music?
I don't know of it before him, and he is quite specific about referring to it as gypsy music in his book. I know he calls it Zigeunermusik in German. This, of course, raises immediately the question of what's gypsy music and what's Hungarian folk song and whether Liszt had the slightest idea about one or the other.
Well, people often point out that his book isn't necessarily as authoritative as it might be.
He wasn't an ethnomusicologist, so it's rather useless to expect him to be like Béla Bartók was, although Bartók is one of the people who actually defended Liszt's book, because he maintained that all you had to do was sensibly detach one thing from the other and then you could understand what he was talking about. Liszt's book doesn't say it's about Hungarian folk song, but Liszt does use Hungarian folk songs in some of his pieces. And the question really is just where he heard them, but I think most of what Liszt heard was played by gypsy bands. And I don't think he ever heard too many unaccompanied washerwomen singing in the countryside. He didn't go out to look for Hungarian songs like that, but he certainly knew lots of groups of performing musicians.
The bells you can hear are the bells of Old Buda. I am standing at the entrance of the Institute of Musicology, a part of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. I'm about to talk to Katalin Kowalczyk, an expert on Roma and Gypsy life. Why did Liszt feel he had to write this book about Gypsy music?
When Liszt wrote the third series of the Hungarian Rhapsodies, he asked Mari Dagó to write a short introduction, but she didn't do it. And later, the new companion of Liszt, Caroline Sen-Wittgenstein, started to write this introduction. And the specialists of Liszt think that most part of the book was written by her and not by Liszt. But the specialists think that Liszt agreed with the text of Caroline Sen-Wittgenstein, and they published it on the name of him. He wanted to glorify Gypsy life because he had a new way of composing. And there was this romantic ideal about Gypsies, that they are free and they are the children of the nature. And Liszt, as a romantic composer, wanted to show himself as free. And that's why he could find connection with the life of the Gypsies that was positive.
We're sitting in the lovely office of Peter Suhai, who is the curator of the exhibition about Liszt and Gypsy life and Gypsy music here at the Ethnographic Museum in Budapest. And Peter is the man who puts the exhibition together. Peter, what is the connection between Liszt and Gypsy music?
It seems that Liszt had been acquainted with Gypsy music from early childhood and had always been as excited by the idea of Gypsy life, that is to say, as far as he understood it from books as by the music itself. Some people think that Liszt identified with Gypsies and their nomadic lifestyle because he himself was constantly on the move. He also saw a close and exciting resemblance between the way gypsies performed and he himself performed.
Which musicians did Liszt actually know personally?
We know all that from his books, where he writes about gypsies, or rather about those gypsies who made an impression on him. The gypsy violinist about whom he writes at greatest length is János Bihari.
So when Liszt became acquainted with these gypsy musicians, did he meet them in the town? Did he meet them in the countryside?
Liszt was born in Nagy Dobrunja, now a part of eastern Austria. That's to say, in the western part of what had once been Hungary. He couldn't speak Hungarian, but many gypsies were employed at aristocratic courts in the region. There were, for example, various branches of the Esterházy family nearby. The first gypsies served as musicians at such courts. Within a 50-kilometer radius, you had Vienna and Pozsony, the current Bratislava, and also Galánta. Well-known gypsy musicians do, to some extent, become part of Hungarian society. The gentry, the landed aristocracy, can't have a party without gypsy musicians to entertain them. On the other hand, they are fully documented incidents, such as the story of Baron Rogai, who, when he took a fancy to it, would set his gypsy band to climb the trees and serenade his guests from there. In other words, the gypsy musicians, though likely to be showered with money, remain subservient and likely to be humiliated. We shouldn't see their condition through rose-tinted glasses.
The gypsies become representatives of a Hungarian national identity through the first 30, 40 years of the 19th century. But when Liszt is a young man and he's going around the courts, before it becomes a really national music, what would he have been hearing then?
Ezt a zenét játszották, de azért, mert cigányok játszották, ezért nem cigányok.
Liszt did hear gypsies playing, but what they played was not gypsy music. What Liszt argues in his book, which surprises his contemporaries, was that gypsies played the music that they had brought with them from India. What they were actually playing was tunes composed by Hungarians in the 18th century, mostly of the kind we call verbenkos, recruiting music, which is a complex form involving some Turkish elements. The important thing is that at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th, we see a conscious effort to establish a characteristically Hungarian music.
Megteremtik a magyar zenét.
But what is Hungarian music? Liszt talks of happening upon gypsy musicians in rural settings. But the gypsies he names were mostly employees of aristocratic courts in the orbit of Vienna. Who were the court gypsies? How did they get there? Where did they come from? And whose music were they playing? In other words, whose music was Liszt adapting and turning into Hungarian music? Bálon Sárasi is the only living pupil of Kodály and has written extensively about Hungarian gypsy music.
When Liszt heard the gypsies playing, where did they get their music from?
At the end of the 18th century. It was at that time the national movement. And as here in Hungary, we did not have such music than in Austria, Beethoven and Haydn and Mozart. We had nothing Hungarian, only the traditional music played in villages. They had to raise such gypsies, and the best of them had to learn something about the fashionable music, that means the classical music. So, at the end of the 18th century, the best gypsy bands were helped out in the aristocratic courts. They could not learn the score. It was too difficult, but they were accustomed to learn quickly by ear. And at the beginning, also in the time of Liszt, there were very few such ensembles. But as they were the representatives of the Hungarian music, they could attach to the Hungarian national music, and they remained entertainment musicians on the peasant level, first of all. These musicians had to represent the Hungarian spirit were already at that time assimilated. Much of them could not speak at that time already gypsy. They are Hungarian.
Yes, but there is still much to learn about the gypsies and the way they developed from poor village entertainers to gypsy kings. What is becoming clearer is that in working with what he called gypsy music, Liszt was trying to create something identifiably Hungarian to go with a rising tide of national feeling. That feeling was to lead to the 1848 revolution and beyond. But isn't it fascinating that he should have turned to the style developed by gypsies from Verbunkos and Csárdás in order to present the Hungarian character? The gypsy musician he most praises is János Bihari, direct seventh-generation ancestor of the living gypsy virtuoso Robi Lakatos.
János Bihari, he was the famous violin player in our family. He was the Hungarian Paganini.
But do you know how Liszt met Bihari?
I think it's absolute in Vienna, because he was the gypsy violin player and the orchestra by Franz Joseph in the Habsburg time, and Liszt played there, of course, a lot of time. And then he meet there, and then I think he's coming a very good friend. And the more interesting, all 21 Hungarian Rhapsody, list is right, the main theme came from Bihari.
What Bihari János was playing, was he playing his original compositions, or was he setting tunes, folklore music that he found amongst Hungarian people?
This is the way from the gypsy, because when a gypsy came first time in the 13th century in Europe, all gypsies going in different countries. And the musician, it's taken the local folklore music from there. Like a Hungarian stay in Hungary, so the Hungarian gypsy play the Hungarian folklore music. So this is a gypsy style, because the gypsy is not learning the violin, so it's absolute authentic, so it came from the esprit, really. Gypsy style, of course, he was play the violin with a lot of glissando, and the vibrato is absolutely different. So I just know some small theme in my head. It's a kind of rhapsody from Liszt. So this is the main theme from from Bihari, the gypsy version, so the Csárdás version is just like this.
So what do you think of Liszt's arrangements of the original tunes?
It's fantastic. I love very much all Hungarian Rhapsody, and the most famous is the second. In this Rhapsody, there is Csárdás, there is all kind of style, but really, really Hungarian gypsy music style. I love very much.
The period after the dramatic failure of the revolution was a time of mourning. People wanted consolation. The sweet, sad music provided by the gypsies, a form of celebrating by weeping, led to the rise of the nauta, the sentimental lament whose energy was fed by the kind of grandeur and melancholy found in European Romanticism generally, but given a particularly keen interpretation by gypsy musicians. It was as if Hungarians had said to the gypsies, be us, speak for us, if only in music. Hungarian spirit was fast becoming synonymous with gypsy music, not only at home, but abroad too. Simon Broughton is the editor of world music magazine Songlines and has travelled widely in Hungary in search of gypsy musicians.
I don't think there was any official attempt to sort of brand Hungary as the country of gypsy music. But I think in the 19th century, it was just an image of the country that writers drew on, that composers drew on, and artists drew on. Indeed, that exhibition in the Ethnographic Museum, you just see what a regular theme it was in art, a romanticised idea of these itinerant, music-loving gypsies. I think it does relate to the idea of the noble savage, which was also a popular concept. I mean, in the gypsies, you have people who are unpredictable, uncontrollable, subversive. So there's an appealing sort of danger around them. And certainly you get that in operetta, which became hugely popular towards the 19th century, early 20th century, what they called Silver Age operetta, composers like Lehár and Emmerich Kallmann. Ich bin ein Zigeunerkind, Lieb und Hass wie keiner. Ruder Rest, ich nirgends Kind, ich bin ein Zigeuner.
Hogy Liszt-e
Liszt saw gypsies as an exotic people. The fact that he attributes the nation's music to the gypsies, who he believes brought this music out of India, shows his admiration of gypsies. In fact, he is almost unique in not speaking of gypsies in a patronizing or pitying way. He is living in a time that is greatly fascinated by exoticism, by what we now call Orientalism.
When Liszt wrote his book, it was at least partly intended to serve as an introduction to a new kind of music, his own Hungarian rhapsodies. The book offered a musical, cultural, ethnic, and spiritual guide. But how far did it describe the actual lives of gypsies? How important was it to them? Did it raise their social prestige? Or was it yet another case of exoticism, imposing an interpretation on a powerless subject?
It's very easy to criticise Liszt for getting lots of things wrong in his book. I think more important is the fact that he did really like this music and was really impressed by it. And doing what he did with it, which is essentially put it onto a classical concert stage, he did get people to notice it who wouldn't otherwise have encountered or been interested in this music. So it did give it an air of respectability.
Hungarian people was very scandalised. Where from thinks Liszt that this music belongs to gypsies? Even if it was virtuoso music, it was harmonized with Liszt's taste. And he did not control where from the gypsies have these melodies. He see the gypsies playing without score. And also how the gypsies transposed simply song melody into instrumental music is not difficult. That was already something original to Liszt.
What was the attitude of the gypsies to Liszt?
There was one gypsy in the 1860s, Farkas, his name, hearing that Liszt says that this is the music of the gypsies, he said in a newspaper, "I'll go to Liszt and tell him the truth."
Marta Shevchenko is known all over the world as a folk singer. I'm meeting her on an afternoon of heavy rain in a busy cafe right opposite the opera. She too has her ideas on authentic gypsy music.
The gypsies, they have a quite different music of their own. Their ethnic music is just vocals and all these effects like this, or the aluminium jug. Yeah. So there is nothing to do with all these violins. It's just a romantic image that, aha, in Budapest, in every corner, you meet a guy in a red vest and with a violin. Sorry, but I think Liszt, the misunderstanding, when he heard these melodies, he thought they were Hungarian melodies, and he used them in his work. They weren't really the Hungarian melodies. But if there was somebody to lead him to the traditions, then he could be our first folk music collector, and I wish I could be an MP3 player in his pocket. And I'm fantasizing always how wonderful material was lost though being recorded.
There are basically two broad groups of gypsies in Hungary, and they play very different music and they have a very different history. So there's what's called the Romongro gypsies, who are largely Hungarian-speaking, have been settled in Hungary much longer. And this is the music that one associates with gypsy music in restaurants, the sort of music that influenced Liszt in his Hungarian rhapsodies. Now, that style, having been hugely popular really up until the end of the communist period, has declined a lot in Hungary. But what's taken its place is a different sort of music played by the Ola gypsies. The word actually is an old Hungarian word for Romanian. And these gypsies came much later in the middle to late 19th century. After slavery was abolished in Romania, gypsies in Romania were slaves until the mid-19th century. And then when they were freed, a lot came to Hungary. They tend to be the Romani-speaking gypsies, and they're much more rural in their lifestyles.
I'm standing right in front of the music academy that Liszt founded together with Erkel in the middle of the 19th century. In fact, it's right opposite the block I lived in before we left this country in 56 after the revolution. There's a photo of me as a child at the side of the building. A year or two after the photograph was taken, I auditioned, unsuccessfully, for a place there as a child pianist. Almost every well-known musician and music historian has passed through these doors, including the great gypsy cimbalom player, Kálmán Balogh.
highest point of the gypsy music was in the 1920s and before that. But after the Second World War, slowly the people, they still loved the gypsy music and the songs, but there was a kind of cultural thinking like that is not real folk music. Bartók and Kodály, they don't hate the gypsy music, just they wanted to say, don't have a mistake. The gypsy music is fantastic, but is not the real Hungarian folk music. Many people try to discover what is really the national identity in the music. And Bartók and Kodály, they told, you can find the real basic things on the land between the peasant people, in the village especially. In the folklore, you are not in style if you are too expressive. Example, there is a very famous melody. Only one girl is on the world. Csak egy kislány van a világon. You can find it in the folklore, but it's so different how in the village peasant will sing you and how the gypsy will play you and how the singer in the city will sing for you. You can do this like Csak egy kislány van a világon. Ja, da, 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 da. If coming here is a primash, he will do that. The band play. What we are talking about now, that is the city style, what is really romantic and very dramatic and expressive. But when we are talking about village gypsy musicians who are playing for peasant people far from the other culture, they are playing very simple. The people on the earth, there you can find really the spirit of the nation. The gypsies who are not musicians, their folk music is again folk music, is not something theatrical. Even today you can find different groups between the gypsies. Outside from the cities, in small village or out from the villages, there are still some communities who have their own music, songs, dances, and that is folklore.
You can show the difference between three kind of Hungarian gypsy music. The original normal gypsy music, the gypsy heritage. Then we have the so-called gypsy music, which has nothing to do with gypsy culture. And we have the Hungarian instrumental folk music, where also gypsies are the best musicians. But this is not called gypsy music. This is instrumental folk music, dance music, yes.
What was a typical ensemble in a Hungarian village before the gypsies? What were the instruments?
In the old times, there were no ensembles. Even when the gypsies came here, they wandered in twos. One made the melody, another made some accompaniment, bagpipe music, flute music. For simple people, it is enough one instrument.
When the Hungarians welcome Liszt and they want to show him what we can do, this is Hungarian music, they don't think of going to villages and hearing people playing bagpipes.
He expressed his wish to go around in Hungary and collect music. But with Liszt's taste, they could not collect original Hungarian peasant music. It was too primitive for him. This is not music. It was not music for a romantic ear.
Liszt in his book describes a visit to a gypsy encampment and a fete. This is what he says. A fete was offered to us, which took place in the woods. It was in the month of October, the sun rays having still some force and spreading a slight sensation of warmth. A great banquet had been prepared for some hundreds of peasants, gathered together from various surrounding villages, all belonging to the same landlord, who had selected this day for the purpose of making good to them a year's taxes. That was written back in 1859. But what is village life like now? And what of the music? I'm setting out on this tracks to find out how life has changed in the intervening century and a half, through two world wars and communism, to now. Well, I've travelled across the Great Hungarian Plain, 3 hours from Budapest to Nyíregyháza, country city, and then in a car, about another half an hour, through ever poorer villages, down to Pasab, which is where the band Parnograst, which means white horse, where they started, where